everyone, and welcome to episode number 9 of Unapologetically Overcoming, the podcast. I'm your host, Jess Marie. I'm very excited for you all to listen to this episode, as it was my very first interview with someone that I don't actually know or didn't know before we recorded this episode. She is going to talk about her mental health journey and her diagnosis with bipolar disorder, along with telling us about the book that she wrote. So I hope you all enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed talking with her. All right. So if you would like to introduce yourself, let our listeners know who you are, what you do, a little bit about yourself, that would be great.
You bet. Thank you, Jess. My name's Kit O'Malley, and I'm an author of a memoir called Balancing Act, Writing Through a Bipolar Life. I am a mental health advocate. I'm very active online sharing information. I volunteer for my local National Alliance on Mental Illness. It's NAMI, in NAMI, mm-hmm. Central Oregon. I live in Central Oregon in the mountains. I speak publicly, basically through podcasts and also through for NAMI. And I'm a former psychotherapist.
Awesome.
So, yeah, those are kind of, I think, and I'm a mom of a 22-year-old. And I'm a wife of 25 years.
Wow, so that's kind awesome.
A lot of people have ideas of what somebody with bipolar disorder, I live with bipolar disorder, can and can't do. Well, you can have long-term successful relationships and you can parent well.
That's great. I think that's a great thing to point out for our listeners.
Yeah.
So since you mentioned about your bipolar diagnosis, when were you diagnosed?
I wasn't diagnosed with bipolar until I was 39. I was diagnosed with depression from the time I was 18. I was suicidal at 18 until I was 39. Mm-hmm. And then from 18 to 30, I just did psychotherapy to cope with it, my depression. And then at 30, I became so depressed I couldn't get out of bed. And I called my parents up. I'm like, I can't even get out of bed. I can't do this any longer. And they said, why don't you see your doctor for some medication? So I went and I was prescribed an SSRI, Prozac, the first SSRI. And then I felt like I was going to jump out of my skin. So my internist, my regular doctor, gave me a second, a sedating antidepressant to kind of counteract that side effect. And my parents said, well, since you're having side effects, why don't you see a psychiatrist just for a second opinion? And the psychiatrist took me off first the Prozac, then the second medication, the trazodone, and he put me on a tricyclic. And at that point, after all these changes and on the tricyclic, I became full-blown manic. And I had a manic episode for 1 week. I was thinking in binary at the same time that I was thinking about Christian mystic saints, at the same time as I was thinking about chaos theory. And I had these, you know, simultaneous streams of thought racing through my head. And after a week, a friend of mine called my parents and my priest and said, Kit needs help. And so my dad flew up and my priest came over with a seminarian who also had bipolar disorder who had bipolar disorder. They were shocked that I did not end up being diagnosed bipolar disorder. I got on antipsychotics for 3 days to nip it in the bud. And then I was put back on antidepressants at a low dose, just observing. And then I ended up not being able to cope. My brain was still broken from that psychotic episode.
Yeah.
So I moved back in with my parents and into my recovery, just to recover. And the psychiatrist down where my parents lived put me on asked me, has anybody ever talked to you before about lithium? And I said, no, but I'll go on lithium.
Yeah.
You think that I'm bipolar? And he said, well, I think that this was because of the medication. So we're gonna try you an antidepressants and see how it goes. So every time before that week of mania, I'd never had those sort of symptoms. I just was like a workaholic, basically.
Yeah,
that, That I was. And it wasn't, bipolar 2 wasn't in the DSM at that point in time.
Okay.
It was just bipolar regular, just full-blown mania. And they thought, well, that full-blown mania, we think, is because of the medications.
Mm-hmm.
So they put me on low dose every time. If my thoughts would start racing, I'd call, he'd reduce the dose, titrate it up slower. And I was on antidepressants throughout my 30s
mm-hmm.
until at 39, I started feeling euphoria again.
Okay.
And at that point, I was a mother, and I was like, okay, I got to nip this in the bud. I got a kid. I can't be symptomatic, you know, with mm-hmm. bipolar symptoms or euphoria. So the euphoria was, I was feeling like God was hauling me to one church for Bible study and to another church for spiritual direction. And although my behavior was fine
mm-hmm.
and what I was doing was fine, and it could very well be that God was calling me to do those things.
Yeah.
I also, and I'm actually somebody, I'm a former psychotherapist.
Uh-huh.
I think it's possible to have symptoms and the symptoms to be symptoms of mental illness, but the content of the symptoms to be valid. And I think
gotcha.
We have to respect and listen to the content of the symptoms. Yeah. Sometimes it might just be very self-destructive and not,
mm-hmm.
but still, I think that somebody needs to be listened to. And if somebody has a theme going throughout their life, it could be that theme is a meaningful theme.
Yeah, so, of course.
So I ended up at that point in time diagnosed bipolar. So, but as soon as I was diagnosed bipolar, and this is like, I know your thing is about stigma.
Yes.
You know, it's a big theme on overcoming stigma.
Yes, absolutely.
Fighting it. As soon as I was diagnosed bipolar, I put my kid in daycare
mm-hmm.
and went back to work because I thought that even though I was the same person,
mm-hmm.
I thought as soon as my diagnosis changed from depressed to bipolar, that I would no longer be a good mother to my child, that I had a progressive, serious mental illness, and that mm-hmm. I was unsafe.
Isn't it funny how that switch happened in your brain? Like, probably because of other things that you heard about a diagnosis
yes.
like that. So you automatically started thinking like,
right.
I
not only
do
had I heard it, but I had treated people with bipolar disorder right. when I was in my 20s.
Right.
I treated adolescents in residential treatment. So it was a diagnosis I was familiar with.
Yeah.
So I was trained. So it wasn't just society. I was trained that this was a serious progressive mental illness.
Yeah.
And so I was the exact same person, just with a different label.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not like anything had changed in me. I was
right.
the same person.
Yeah.
I just had a different diagnosis and different medication.
Uh-huh.
So my, you know, it's not like I had all of a sudden become this different person. I was the same person. So that was incredibly painful to have to feel that way.
Yeah.
And that was the theme of the early years of my son's life after that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And even I tried to get work for a couple of years, but I found it untenable. I was trying to work and mother a kid who turned out to be a very high needs kid. We didn't know at that time he was a toddler. Mm-hmm. He had ADHD and depression, anxiety were related to migraines. He had severe gastrointestinal migraines. So he was just this kid who just was he's a very sensitive kid,
mm-hmm.
but now he's a 22-year-old college student. So, but anyway, so I ended up not being able to do everything, you know, and I mm-hmm. ended up voluntarily hospitalizing myself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was hospitalized for 2 weeks
uh-huh.
and in partial hospitalization for about 4 months. And partial hospitalization is kind of, people could think of it as day treatment. It's basically your job to go to the hospital, to an outpatient portion of the hospital, not inpatient,
mm-hmm.
and to be there all day in group therapy, like, you know, occupational therapy, art therapy, yoga, go for a walk, you know what I mean? It's like the whole day was structured, mental health recovery therapy. And it was an excellent program. So, but after that, since then I've been on a disability.
Okay.
And my theme throughout that, like the therapists would say, your theme, what you keep on saying is that you want to be a good enough mother. That you're concerned about being a good enough mother.
Yeah.
And looking back over my life, because parenting our son was very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
He regularly, as a 22-year-old, thanks me for how I parented him.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know. And how many 22-year-olds thank their mom?
I know. So that definitely says something then about,
yes,
you know, how those stigmas maybe aren't really accurate, because
correct,
not only did you do it, but he even recognized that you were doing it, even though you had, you know, all this other stuff going on. So
right.
That's awesome.
Right. Right. Because we did basically whatever it takes to help him was mm-hmm. our focus, but I had to take care of myself too.
Absolutely.
And that's something that was that's kind of why, you know, I did get the, you know, like called the advice nurse immediately once I started to recognize the symptoms,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, it's one thing to me, it's so important as a parent that you take care of yourself.
Absolutely.
And that you take care of your mental health. Now, yeah. The internalized stigma was horrible and painful,
mm-hmm.
but that I took positive steps
mm-hmm.
in terms of getting in, going to a psychiatrist, you know,
yeah.
and getting on the correct medications. And when I felt that I wasn't able to handle it, that I voluntarily went to the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, I said, I need to be here.
Yeah. So which I feel like you don't hear a lot. Like a lot of times it's someone like almost forcing someone to go do that. So I think that's huge too, that you were able, and maybe it was, you know, the fact that you worked in the field and you not only recognized it, but also realized I need to do something about it. But that, I do think that's huge, because I know there's a lot of people who, you know, they deny that there's anything going on and they refuse to get any kind of help, whether it just be something as simple as talking to someone or, you know, going inpatient or taking medication and all those things. So I think that's,
right.
That's huge that, you know, you were able to recognize it and take the steps that you needed to address it so that you could take care of yourself and take care of your son. Cause let's be right. honest, being a parent is hard enough. And then you add, you know, the stuff you had going on, the stuff your son had going on. So that's really a lot.
Right. So I did have the benefit of having insight, like you were mm-hmm. talking about. And yep. I had experience since I was 18. I was suicidal at 18. So I'd been in therapy since I was 18.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of therapy. And then I had the master's in psychology.
Yep.
And I was a licensed therapist. So all of that helped. But I still had, you know, struggling with, you know, some would call it denial, but, you know, there was some denial, but then also there's something called anosognosia, like you're talking about, which is lack of insight, where mm-hmm. somebody isn't purposefully, you know,
right.
Not seeking treatment, but doesn't see that they need, you know, doesn't believe that they need
yeah.
it. It's just
yeah.
part of, it's not a fault.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're doing anything bad. That's just, you know, how their brain sees themselves.
Yeah.
So, but when I was in my 20s, I remember there were times when my dad would say, oh, it's too bad you couldn't just take a pill and feel better, you know, before I ever took
my yeah. medication,
I would blow up at him. You know, I'd be so defensive.
Yeah.
As if therapy was, you know, the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when medication ended up, although medication did trigger a horrendous mania.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's being on the proper medication at the proper dose at the right time, which changed over my lifetime.
Yeah. Did you, like, looking back now, prior to that manic episode, can you think of any, like, anything, signs maybe, or anything like prior to that, that could have been that and you just didn't recognize it?
Yes, but I was a workaholic,
mm-hmm.
like always.
Mm-hmm.
So, and so I was very extreme high achiever, and then I would crash. You know, because it wasn't sustainable and ongoing.
Yeah.
You know, ongoing to work those sort of hours or to achieve at that level. And but back then in the 80s, in early 90s, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that is used by the United States, you know, U.S. clinicians to diagnose mental health issues, was not, did not have, it only had bipolar in it. And that was like what we call now bipolar one.
Okay.
Which is, you know, severe mania. It didn't have what's called bipolar two, which would be milder mania. So that would, you know, the workaholism and stuff would be considered that. I wasn't doing things that were, I wasn't promiscuous. I wasn't spending all of my money. You know, I wasn't psychotic like I was when I had that reaction to the medication.
Yeah.
Full blown. That was definitely mania.
Yeah.
So, but that was not yet considered a diagnosable bipolar disorder. It didn't meet the threshold. Now that people now bipolar two, which is sort of, you know, which I do not currently have, ever since I've been hospitalized, is considered bipolar one, which I didn't even realize until later. I don't think it's really even matters whether it's one or two.
Yeah. But
it's just, it's a spectrum disorder, right? It's,
right. Yeah.
Go from really, and I knew that I very, at the very least, when I was in my 30s, I would talk to clinicians and I said, you know, I'm at the very least, I'm cyclothymic, which would be bipolar three, which isn't considered something, generally speaking, that's medicated. But I knew that my highs were higher than most people's highs and my lows were lower than most people's lows. But what would get treated was the depression and not the high achievement, you know. But every time I'd have to crash and start over, you know. So I have this resume of multiple jobs and multiple careers. Although looking back over it, everything makes sense as I'm now 59.
Yeah.
So I can look back over my career and I say, you know what, all these skills and things that I did helped me, first of all, be a better wife and mother, you know, in psychology. And and when my, when I was taking care of my parents or helping to take care of them, they were in memory care. They both had dementia at the end of their lives. And learning, I was a, you know, I had been like pre-med, then legal studies, you know, legal assistant, then psychology, then I went into real estate. So I had this varied career path and every single issue that I had gone through in my career path helped me deal with issues that are end of life issues, you know, in terms of financial and legal and medical and psychological, you know, behavioral and dealing with their house. Yeah. So it, you know, then I was like, wow, I always wondered why I had this, you know, career path. And I was like, this is why. Okay. What I wanted to say was that when you're going through a challenge, I would never tell somebody, oh, there's a purpose for it. Right. Because that's just not compassionate. When something you're going through something, there's no reason. It's not like you deserved the pain or the struggle or the challenge. You don't.
Yeah.
No, no. But in retrospect, when you're out of the crisis and you're in a stable place, mental health recovery, I have found it useful to find purpose in what I've gone through.
Definitely.
And my purpose has been to help others and to speak and share my story. Yeah. To fight stigma, like you're doing, all these things that you're doing with your podcast.
Yeah.
That's a purpose that we can use, that we can find in our life experience. And I think everybody has purpose.
Yes.
Everybody is loved and loving and lovable, right?
Absolutely.
We're not alone, and we all are here for a reason, whether or not you understand that reason, that you have value.
Yeah.
I think that it's so important that we understand that we all have value at, in our uniqueness.
Yes, definitely. I agree with that 100%.
It's almost like, I should remember the name, how to say this name, but they're in, there's a Japanese type of pottery where it's broken pottery that they put back together with gold.
Oh,
And so it's more beautiful in its brokenness, having been put back together.
Yes.
So
I love that.
And I found that people who've known me over the course of my lifetime, from when I used to be like the perfectionist with a facade to when I'm, you know, how I am now, or mm-hmm. over my, have said, you know, you're more likable now. Because I don't have to be, act like I'm perfect, because right. I'm not, and that's okay.
Yeah. And no one is. So I think the more people that hear that and understand that, the better off we're all going to be, because, exactly. you know, a lot of people, I think, try to act certain ways because they think that there's no room for imperfection, but imperfection is a huge part of all of us.
Exactly.
So that's definitely important to remember for everyone. So we kind of already discussed, you know, your treatment course and some of the stigmas related to bipolar disorder. What would be something that you would want people to know about someone who has bipolar or that's in the process of maybe being diagnosed with it?
Well, first of all, I think that it's not something that somebody can just snap out of. Mm-hmm. So I'd be very supportive of them seeking help, but very understanding that the path of mental health recovery is, first of all, not linear. So they're going to have setbacks.
Yes.
They're still going to be symptomatic. Mm-hmm. And that finding the correct treatment course is not easy. It's not like you take a blood test and you say, oh, your blood sugar's low, let's do that, you know, or whatever,
yeah.
you know, and you know exactly what to do. It's an imperfect right now, how it's trial and error in terms of getting medications right, finding the right treatment, the right psychotherapy, the right psychotherapist, mm-hmm. all these things are trial and error. And yes. so because it's trial and error, I tell people, first of all, don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
It can take, it takes time.
Yeah.
If you don't like your therapist, try another one.
Yeah.
If the medications aren't working, tell your doctor.
Yes.
If the side effects are intolerable, tell your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just keep on trying. And for those people who are supporting you, I would be supportive, but don't expect somebody to just snap out of it.
Yeah. Those are all very important things, especially about things taking time, because I think sometimes people just think that it's going to be like a switch when they start medicine or when they start counseling or those things. And it's not, it's a process. And I think people who are both going through it and helping someone, you know, go through it need to understand that it is a process.
Yeah.
And it's not going to happen immediately.
Right. And it doesn't mean, even if you are on, like, I'm considered stable, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean I'm symptom less.
Right. Yeah.
I still experience symptoms. My brain and body are different, and I have to take care of them. What I can and can't do, I have to pay attention to, right?
Yeah.
I can't do the workaholism I used to do.
Yeah.
So I do what I can when I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good enough.
Yeah.
And I try to take care of myself. I don't always take care of myself as well as
I should. I think that's a struggle for most of us. Mm-hmm. All right. So I like to ask all of my guests if they have a quote, maybe an inspirational message that could relate to overcoming, or maybe just something that resonates with you. Do you have one that you would like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I actually said it earlier, and I'm going to say it again.
Okay.
It's, you know, and it's are enough. You are enough. You are loved.
Mm-hmm.
You are lovable mm-hmm. as you are.
Yes.
And you are capable of loving. And really, that's, to me, love is all that, the bottom line. If you can love and be loved, which you can no matter what, we are all lovable in our imperfection as we are made. That's the most important thing.
Yes. Yes, definitely. So where can people find you? Do you have a website, social media? Where can people get the book?
The book's on Amazon, and there's a link on my website, and lots of good information on my website, not just about my story, but in general. You know, some resources and stuff like that. It's Kit, K-I-T-T, O'Malley, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y.com. If you put Kit O'Malley into a browser, you'll find me.
Okay, perfect.
I'm all over social media. So two T's and two L's, Kit with two T's and O'Malley with two L's.
Got it. And I will link all of that information in the episode description for today.
I want to thank Kit so much for talking with me and for sharing her story with all of us. I will link all of her information in the episode description for today, including where you can purchase her book. Thank you to everyone for listening. And don't forget, as Kit mentioned, no matter what you have going on in your life, you are enough. Make sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at unapologetically_overcoming. And remember, be kind to yourself, be kind to each other, and be unapologetically you.